Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. I am so excited for this week's show. We are talking to Dr. Maurice Jackson, a prolific author whose new book, Rhythms of Resistance and Resilience, How Black Washingtonians Used Music and Sports in the Fight for Equality, is absolutely powerful stuff. And as you may imagine, it hits me right in the mind and the heart. Love this book. You're going to love this interview with Dr. Maurice Jackson. Also, we are talking to Ari Drennan, the Media Matters LGBTQ program director, about their recent study on the politics of MMA and the UFC. So excited for this week's show. Let's first go to Dr. Maurice Jackson. Maurice Jackson, thank you so much for joining us on the Edge of Sports podcast.
It's my pleasure indeed to be here.
I'm so glad we're making this happen. Well, I just want to start with a little bit about yourself before we get into this remarkable book. How did you come to be fascinated by the rhythms and the culture of Washington, D.C.?
Well, I came to Washington in the mid-70s, and I often say I have another book coming out next year. It's called Halfway to Freedom. It's the whole history of African Americans. And it's been my thing, because when I came to Washington, I didn't want to stay in Washington. I wanted to get to New York City. I wanted to get to the music, the sports. I just wanted to, and I came here. I got very active in left-wing politics and got married. But the one thing that I knew that as I was became active, that I needed a release. And a release was always in music and sports. And even if I couldn't go see them, I could read about them. I remember the first book I ever bought on sports was this book here, When You Were Nowhere. I have a tattered copy, as I have of many things. And so I always read about it. And growing up, and my wife sometimes asked me, and I'd be talking with some of the fellas, how do you all know? You don't remember to go to the grocery store, but you remember all these facts, all these details, Hort Wilhelm and a knuckleball, all these things. Who? And it just became a part of barbershop talk of things. Because when men go to barbershops, they, you know, we're not talking about anything obscene. We're talking about sports and who hit the ball the farthest. And so we had all these legends. And I grew up with, I was young when Willie Mays and the Say It Could and everybody was there. But there was always a story of the great Satchel Paige. And so there's hidden stories about that. And same thing with music. Always a story about Louis Armstrong, wherever you went. And later on, I became to become quite knowledgeable about these men. I'm by no means a sports historian or even a music historian, but I use those things. And I have a list, downstairs I have hundreds of books just on sports that I've, and music, especially music that I've read, pretty much to learn about the history of our people.
You're a generation young for being a huge jazz person. Where did your love for jazz come from?
Well, so I grew up in Newport News, Virginia, and then my folks split up, and I stayed with foster parents for a while. Then I went to live with my grandmother in rural Alabama. Well, Newport News, Virginia, my mother and father, he was a jazz musician. He played in the old Army Air Force Band in the Second War, and great musician. A lot of great musicians did not leave home, like in D.C. Shirley Horn and Bucky, but a lot of stayed home, and especially on the water in Norfolk and Newport News. So whenever the great musicians would come through town, I mean, I remember this guy with a conk coming through, and that was Nat King Cole. I remember Lloyd Price, Ruth Brown. I remember all the great boppers, Gene Ammons coming through town, and my stepfather would play with them. And then he and my mother founded something called the Doshi Kai Club. I don't know where they got the name from. And it was a sister club to the Left Bank Jazz Society. So all the people would come through, and I just had that. Then when I lived with my grandmother in the South, she was a woman with a third grade education. She would every night, she would say, read me the Bible. I would read her the Bible. She said, I don't need you to translate it for me. Just read it. I can get it. Just read it. But every Saturday night, Mark, she would listen to something called Dave's Record Mart, which was in Nashville, Tennessee. And she would listen to the Testicle Hour, which was classical music. And then she'd watch the fights. And the boxing would come on every Sunday, every Saturday and Sunday night. And then she would watch Liberace. Liberace and Lawrence Welk. Now, why? Because if you listen to Liberace and Lawrence Welk, they played every song in the book, every culture. They played klezmer music. They played everything. And you would learn this with these corny musicians. And then she had an old Rockola, you know, old thing, and all the 78s, and Paul Whitman. She had all the great. So I just learned it. I still have the 78s downstairs. And so I just would listen. And when I came to D.C., the first thing I looked for was some of the jazz clubs, if I could afford them. Mm. And I'd go to, Woody's Hilltop by Howard and One Step Down by G.W. And, of course, Blues Alley when I could afford it.
Mm. So maybe you can explain for our listeners, before we get into the book, a question that I'm sure you've pondered over the decades. Like, what is the difference between what people think of as Washington and then D.C.?
Well, I don't think. Generally, when people think of Washington, they think of official Washington. They think of the Capitol, the White House, and things like that. Generally, when people think of D.C., they really say the DMV. I know you go to somewhere and you can see somebody from Tacoma Park or somebody from Prince George. They say, I'm from D.C. Well, not so much now because you can't even see PG now. You can't say PG. You have to say Prince George, mainly because of Kevin Durant and some of the great basketball players from there. But D.C. is just the... And it's taken different names over the last period of time. It's taken, you know, when I first came to D.C., they called it the Lost Colony, because D.C. was considered a colonial possession. And theoretically, certainly wasn't. It's not Guam or Puerto Rico. And then later became Chocolate City, because D.C. became, in 1957, it became the first city with a majority of black population. By 1970, it's 70%. They called it Chocolate City. Now, it's 42% African American, so we see the gentrification. But D.C. Really is the inner city. It is the D.C. of regular working people and black people.
Mm. Do you think we say the DMV now because gentrification has pushed black D.C. to some of the poorer areas in the surrounding environment?
I think so. You know, like Prince George's County is called, not called Ward 9, the 8 wards in Washington, D.C. So they call it Ward 9. And of course, it's mainly because of so many, you know, great ball players, Michael Sweetney, and who I taught, and Jeff Green, who I taught. And then, of course, Durant. But DMV, it's Department of Motor Vehicles, of course, but it's DMV for the greater area. And people like to say it. I'm from the DMV. You know, a person from Silver Spring. Well, Silver Spring is a lovely place, but you're not going to say I'm from Silver Spring. You're going to say I'm from D.C.
So. Yeah. So you mentioned these numbers, Chocolate City, 70%. What made Washington, D.C. such an attractive point for people undergoing black migration or looking for work or a place to settle? Why D.C.?
Well, because it was jobs. People came for jobs. People left. If you talk to almost anybody from D.C. was over 40 or 50, they have some roots in what we call Kakalaki. That's North Carolina. And they came up. I came from Virginia. I wanted to get to New York, but many came here and left a federal job. Do you know the last week Elon Musk said something? He said that public workers have done more to harm America than Hitler's done to Germany. And I think, as he did the Nazi salute. Well, what this man doesn't know is that public workers mean school teachers, bus drivers, firemen, garbage workers, people who work. And people came to D.C. Many people came for what they call a GGJ. And GGJ stood for a good government job. And these have been the foundation, but they've also helped build the city. And one that was, you know, Marion Barry made many mistakes, but what Marion Barry used, the city infrastructure, to help build black wealth, but also to help improve the conditions in a lot of black people. Especially with so many. Now the problem is many of the public workers cannot afford to stay in the city. And the public workers, one reason they don't like it because the public workers always have had strong unions. AFSCME, American Federation, state, county, municipal employees, American Federation of Government Employees, all of these, the Teachers Union, or the National Education Association, all of these have strong labor bodies which represent, and black people are widely represented in the black labor in labor unions. So D.C. has been that way, and they're not throwaway jobs. These are people who are very productive in what they do.
Let's take it to D.C. and the musical history, because when I moved to D.C., that was one of the things that blew my mind, was that this was a small city. I mean, I'm coming from New York, so for me, it felt small. It felt like a city you could get your arms around. But the musical history was so incredibly rich. I mean, in terms of iconography, in terms of styles. I mean, can you speak about why D.C. became this hothouse of musical genius, and how does that relate to resistance to racism, resistance to the dominant culture?
Well, one thing about D.C. is many places, in the public schools, music was always a big part of it. Duke Ellington went to Armstrong, you know, not to Dunbar and other schools like that. The great founder of modern black jazz, James Reese Europe, went to Dunbar High School, and he's the one who later, as he found the music, he later went to New York, founded something called the Clef Club, 125 members of big orchestra, later went and became a leader of the Harlem Hellfighters, the Armed Front Purdue, the French called them, in the First War, and fought heroically, and he took jazz there. One day he's playing, he's in bed with pneumonia, and his company commander comes and says, Lieutenant Europe, he was lieutenant, the first black lieutenant in World War I. Lieutenant, you must take this band and start playing because we need the morale. And so he said, well, I'm sick, sir. And the colonel said, no, you must get up and play. So he went up, got the band together, of mainly blacks and a lot of Puerto Ricans he had in the band. And he started playing music. And the French looked at him this way and that way, and then they finally realized he was playing the Marseillaise. He was playing the French national anthem, and jazz stayed there. And he had playbooks like James Reese Europe, and then, of course, William Marion Cook, who taught Duke Ellington. So many people like that. Dvorak, the great Czech composer, studied the music of James Reese Europe. He studied the music of a man named Harry Belief, and all these great people. Okay, so music had that special thing. Of course, they all left and went to New York. Still the modern musicians, Billy Hart, many of we'll come back to that. So D.C. had a place in the public schools. And in those days, you had public schools and you had the Department of Recreation under E.B. Henderson had those things for people. And they existed until about, I don't know, the 1980s. And Ronald Reagan came with these big budget cuts. And the first thing he cut was school recreation, sports program, and music. When he cut the sports, the recreation programs, the first thing happened was the rise of type 2 diabetes, and it spread in two places, mainly the Bronx, New York, and Washington, D.C. We don't know why the numbers are there. And then it took out music, and it's now, luckily, you have a place like Duke Ellington, which does have music in schools. You have certain bands like Blue and others have great marching bands, but it really hurt. But D.C. musicians came, and then there were clubs all up and down U Street. And U Street was sort of a mixture between 125th Street, Harlem, and Wall Street. It was the black Wall Street, per se, and all the musicians. And so you had the Howard Theater and the Lincoln Colonnade and the Republican. All these musicians would come, and Duke and Miss Lena Horne, and they would come. And then, of course, you had the movement towards integration in Washington, D.C., and it really centered around music. It's phenomenal that in 1939, Marian Anderson came, and many of your audience may know this, but I'll make it brief, that the great mezzo-soprano out of Philadelphia Curtis Institute, and she would come every year and sing at Dunbar High School. Well, Dunbar got too small, so then they wanted to go to Central High School, which is now Cadoza High School, but it was a public D.C. high school, and they wouldn't let them sing there. So then they went to try to get D.A.R. Constitution Hall. And Constitution Hall, Doors of American Revolution, said, no, blacks can't perform here. And so a great lady, perhaps our greatest lady, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, got up and stood up for it. And then the Secretary of the Interior stood up, and they performed at the Lincoln Memorial the first time. Now, Dave, you remember a couple of weeks ago when the first Doge orders tried to stop 40 of the most talented classical trained marching band musicians to come to D.C. and they were going to come and play with the U.S. Marine Corps band. And what they did was to stop them. And so musicians, former members of these Marine Corps bands and things, came to Washington and brought this group, and 60 Minutes paid for them to come. And Bill Whitaker interviewed them on 60 Minutes. He said something very beautiful. He says they were going to first play to 200 people. Now they've been on 60 Minutes, they're playing to hundreds of millions. The same thing happened with Marian Anderson. They tried to deny her the right to sing at Constitution Hall, and they sang on the Mall in April of 1939. 75,000 people are there, but millions are hearing it all over. She sang No More Auction Block for Me and Ave Maria, and Were You There When They Crucified My Lord? All these songs. And it became the first time of an integrated, really integrated crowd in Washington, D.C., and it led to the eventual desegregation of the federal government, because even when the federal government was desegregated, Washington, D.C. was still very much integrated. And music, therefore, had a great role. And I can talk about, you know, many other examples, especially examples of the Turkish brothers, Neşve and Ahmet Erdogan, who came to Washington to help integrate the scene through bringing music to the Turkish embassy.
Wow. No, that's amazing in and of itself. What made the Turkish embassy such a hotbed?
Okay. Well, so the Turkish government, the Ottoman Empire was overthrown, and Ataturk became the leader of the country. And he sent a man named Mumia Erdogan to England. And he had two sons, one named Ahmet and one named Neşve. They eventually found the Atlantic Records. And they came to, they had heard Ella Fitzgerald and Sinatra at the Palladium in London. So they came to Washington, and they had this love of jazz. Well, they want to go out at night, and they go to these clubs at 10 or 12, and the ambassador finds out about it, and there's a driver named Cleo Lane who takes him around, a former prize boxer. So the ambassador says, no, you can't, you Muslim, you can't be out here at night. Bring the musicians to the embassy. And they started bringing him Cootie Williams and Dizzy Gillespie and Ella and Jack Teagarden, Artie Shaw, all these great musicians, black, white, Jewish, everything. And a white congressman, I don't know whether it was Stennis or Easton, I can't find out, says you can't bring black people, you know the words he used, to the embassy, to the front door in Massachusetts Avenue. And the ambassador says something that's very much biblical, but also is in the Quran. Sometimes you think, and my grandmother used to say this, in my father's house, there are many mansions. If it were not so, I would not have told you. And he quoted this from the Quranic way. This is my mansion. This is the Lord's, my house. And therefore, I will decide. So he said, if you want to come through the back door, you may. But all these generals come. And so the musicians came. And then they had these concerts. And then later on, these Turkish brothers went up, and a Maxi, Waxy Maxi's record, Max Edelman, who was a prominent Jewish fellow, a dentist, had a record shop. They started working with him. Then they said, we have to take this music out. And they went and started promoting. And so they went to a place at 1530 R Street. 1530 R Street is 16th and R Street. Now, it's the Jewish Community Center. Now, the Jewish Community Center did not know they were bringing jazz. They just knew they wanted to bring a concert. So dig this, as I say. Two Muslim brothers bringing black music to a Jewish community center. Can you imagine if we had such a corporation today? We'd have a much better nation, but we don't, unfortunately, have it. And so they took this music, and then they went on and found Atlantic Records. Atlantic Records, Ornette Coleman, Ray Charles. And Erdogan tells the story that somebody brought some music of these four mophead boys from England. And I listened to it. I wasn't going to produce that. And then he realized it was the Beatles. He lost billions of dollars. So he did later on produce the Rolling Stones. But he was a great producer of many of the great jazz foundation. Ornette Coleman, Coltrane, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, just so many. And that became a part of the role. And they really did help. Integrate the city, because black and whites could not go and listen to music at the same venues in the 40s.
Where does one of the most famous musicians to come from D.C., Duke Ellington, fit into this this incredible lattice work that you've just laid out of musicians, of embassies, promoting jazz. I mean, and did Duke also make Washington, D.C. a kind of a center that people wanted to go to learn jazz?
Well, understand that Duke, like all great musicians, is not going to stay in D.C., so you're going to leave. So Duke is playing. Duke wins a concert, wins a contest, not as a musician, but he painted signs as a kid, a sign painter. He won a contest, and he won a contest to go, and his scholarship was to go to Pratt Institute in New York. But he's playing all along D.C. at something called the Washingtonians and the Colonnades, and he puts together, and he sees just what this music can do for him. Mm-hmm. He says, you know, I thought I could play basketball, but I'm playing music. But all the girls didn't like the basketball players. They liked the pianists. So I never played basketball again, he said. And so he went off to New York. And that's what he, but he always came back. I have a list of all the concerts he played, just hundreds, the Carter Burn, all the great, the Howard Theater and others. But he was Duke. And then Duke, you know, Duke always had a message in his music. He wrote his songs with Billy Strayhorn. One of the his you know, of course we know Take the A Train, which he started up to Harlem. But he in 1943 he had the first concert of a black man at Carnegie Hall, and he played it for Russian War Relief, and he played the songs dedicated to Toussaint Louverture and the Haitian Revolution, Black, Brown, and Beige, and who came there? Cronkite, and Sinatra came from uptown. And Ella Fitzgerald and Mrs. Roosevelt came, and he played this music dedicated to the Haitian. And he used this money for Russian war relief to help the Russian soldiers. You know, sometimes we get confused because of our distaste and dislike for what Putin is doing. But that should not destroy the notion of what the Russians actually did in the Second War, because they lost 50 million. It was just unimaginable. But the United States at the time fought with the Russians, the Soviets, to try to save the world from Nazi Hitler. And Ellington knew this. James Reese Europe, who went over, and he said they were two great musics. He said the Negro spirituals and Russian folk tunes. So he had studied the history of this music. And Ellington did the same thing. And he wrote, and he had music dedicated to Africa, music dedicated to the Middle East, music dedicated to, and also a song for my people, songs dedicated to the civil rights movement. So he is the master. But what made Ellington also beautiful is that he wrote for particular musicians. And so it was the orchestra, but it was also the maestro within the East Orchestra. We see it in sports. We see plays drawn up for people. Ellington did this. And he had a great Johnny Hodges and Cootie Williams and so many others. So everything starts and begins. You know, with two of the great musicians, they would have to be, with our jazz music, would have to be Duke Ellington and, of course, the greatest musician, in my opinion, Louis Armstrong.
Mm. Now,
Louis Armstrong did a lot for Washington.
Boy, yeah, you must have. I'm sure you've seen the documentary soundtrack to A Coup d'Etat.
You know, I haven't seen it yet, and it was somewhere. My wife and I, this is on our schedule tonight. Yeah, I know about it. I am going to see it. Yeah,
maybe the best documentary I've ever seen.
Okay,
and I've seen my share. I mean, the footage of I mean, this was maybe made for you.
Yeah,
Maurice Jackson, because there was foot. I mean, I'm not the jazz head you are, although I love it and was raised on it. I saw footage that I never could have dreamed about seeing of Louis and Dizzy and so many others.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to see it, and of course, I've studied. I was in politics a long time, so I've studied, you know, I've studied coups. I've studied all of this. I've studied the independence movements of Africa and all those in the 50s and 60s. So, yeah, it is on my, I've been doing quite a bit with this book. I'm very fortunate to speak and fortunate to speak to you, but it is on my soon bucket list.
Can't wait to hear what you think about it. I'm going to just say one name to you that comes out of D.C., and of course he didn't stay in D.C. very long, but maybe his influence is greater than all others. The person I consider to be one of the best vocalists of the 20th century, and of course I'm talking about Marvin Gaye. What connections do you see between Marvin Gaye and his legacy, particularly in D.C.?
So thank you. So Marvin Gaye, of course, became a legend. Marvin Gaye also liked to play basketball. He knew
that's right. The photos.
Yeah, and he knew Elgin Baylor and so many others. Marvin Gaye became one of the first who used music as a social method. He took from the old Negro spirits. He took from Paul Robeson. He took from this music, and of course we know him today because all weekend they've been playing his version of the national anthem. At the, I think, the 73 All-Star game. Anyway, so Marvin Gaye, and he wrote songs of meaning, you know, the great songs about, you know, about war and about the struggle. He wrote songs about what's going on and all that, which became the greatest protest music record in American history with Tammy Terrell and others. But he had a message about the meaning of war and rockets, moonshots, spending on the have-nots. And so what he said was the using all this money for weapons going to these military-industrial complex. He had this inner-city blues. He talked about the roles of the inner-city people and the blacks. And he did it at a particular time because he has a brother who went to Vietnam and came back hooked on drugs and had PTSD and things like that. So Marvin Gaye, and he became that. And then, of course, he had his demons. He went through a period where he could not produce, and then he had another stride where he became the start of the social conscience. And there have been several people, Marvin Gaye, and in his light, of course, Gil Scott-Heron, and then, of course, Sweet Honey and the Rock. These are people who use music to speak about the conditions in Washington, but also in the inner city.
Legends all around. I know I want to get to sports because it's such a part of your book, and, of course, it's part of this podcast, but I'd be remiss if we're going to talk about DC and music and not talk about Go-Go. What I found so interesting when I moved to DC was how important Go-Go was, but how little I had ever come across it in my travels in the United States before coming to DC. Can you explain Go-Go to us, like, well, its origin and why it stayed so in these borders?
Well, Go-Go is of course the music of DC. We associated mainly with Chuck Brown. Chuck Brown from North Carolina came. Spent time in Lorden Prison. It's the pulsating beat. It's that back beat. It's that bass. It's that bass drum. And how did it come about? Well, it's a product of pre hip hop and things like that. If you listen to the way he sings, you hear a lot of Louis Armstrong, and you hear the scatting in the plays, and you hear the Go-Go came apart because in this period where they didn't have music in the schools, the guys had to produce, and ladies produced their own music. They did it with their voice, and you know, Louis Armstrong tells the story that he started scatting, and you hear the scatting in there. He started scatting because he's playing with an orchestra or something. He drops his music on the ground. And he doesn't know what to do. Zabba-dabba-doo-ba-dabba-doo. So he starts scatting. And if you listen to Go-Go, it's a lot of that. And but it's also the beat. They make their own instruments. They've taken it, you know, out of the school. So they take buckets, these drywall buckets, and started beating and things like that. But it's the beat. It is that back beat. And then it resonated, within the city. And there have been many great books. Charles Stevens has written a great book. Natalie Hopkinson has written a great book on. So Go-Go is the the music. And Chuck Brown, he plays with him because he and a woman named Eva Cassidy put together a record, and they play dedicated to Duke Ellington, to the great song. So he plays, and then of course a superior guitar player. But it was a place for people to go on Saturday night. You know, I know in England they had something called Sklar. They had all this something like that. They had all this music, but they just play, and you never stop. You just keep. And certain cities have certain beats, you know, and certain dances. In D.C., this became a lot. And so now they played Go-Go at the Kennedy Center. They played it at the different schools. And see, here's the thing. People assume when they listen to great musicians that they have no study of the music. Now, Chuck Brown did not have the education that Duke Ellington had in the sense of understanding a chordal structure and things like that. But he understood it in his head, and he could play and he could develop from that and had a great appreciation. But now Go-Go is going to the schools and people are doing plays and everything else. And it's taking off. I'm a jazz man, so I have, you know, am I going? But here's the thing. cocoa became so important, you see, that it took over going up and down U Street. And a couple of years ago, when gentrification came, people moved in and they wanted to stop people from singing, playing go-go music in the city. And they saw that that wasn't going to work. So it was just a lack of appreciation for it. But it is the music of a people struggling to survive and express themselves.
And you mentioned a few years ago, it really became a movement in D.C. And a hot button issue. Like, will gentrifiers be allowed to shut down go-go?
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, this guy walks to Howard University, and the last book after this one, I write a lot about him. He goes there and he's walking his dog, and some of the students say, "Why are you walking your dog? You can't let your dog defecate here." And he says, "Well, why don't you move the university?" So he doesn't know that this university is founded after Reconstruction, the premier Black institution in the world. And he has that attitude. People move into these neighborhoods. They want you to change. I don't know if you've seen, but in D.C., people now are starting to paint houses. Nowadays, people leave the house red brick, but now there's neighborhoods. And the census, somebody went through the census, and they could say if the houses are painted white, a light blue, or light gray, you can tell when people are moving in. You can paint your house. But it's to signify that we are here, that a new element. People often assume that just because you're young and white, you are somewhat liberal. It's not true. Some could be. I came to D.C. in the 70s, and there were great, people who came for the war on poverty and people like that. So many older whites, and they're older now. But they worked with Black people. They cared. I'm not so sure many care now. Many care about the price of the house. D.C. schools now are more integrated than they were 40 years ago. More segregated, I'm sorry. 90% of white kids don't go to school with Black kids. 90% of Black kids don't go to white. The only places that are really integrated are Wilson High School, Duke Ellington School for the Arts, the School Without Walls, and Banneker. But even at Wilson today, there's a movement among certain parents to stop students from outer boundaries to coming in, because what happens is so many young whites are moving into the city and they may live in that area. So before, where the school wanted, now whether it will last now, I don't know, because Wilson also likes to have good sports teams. So
yeah, we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a school we know well in my home. So excuse me. So let's get to sports here, because in the time we have, I don't want to abuse the time that you have, because I really do appreciate it.
No, I have time, yeah.
I'm just going to start just by telling you this. Like, growing up in New York, my first team, what was St. John's, with Chris Mullin and then Walter Berry. That was like as a young person, that was my first team. And then the big bad taking on St. John's was, of course, Georgetown. And it took several years before I knew that Georgetown was not an HBCU. And I know other people have said that, and I've heard that. And it's so wild to me to think that this school that, of course, I now know is existing in an area, you know, without metro service, in an area of tremendous wealth, in an area, in a school that, you know, certainly in the early 80s was very largely white, gave off this impression of being an HBCU. And it was through the presence of John Thompson that as a young man I was like, okay, this is a Black school. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the roots of John Thompson, and can you speak about his ability to have that impact? Mm-hmm. As well as his position not just at Georgetown but in the city, in a region, and the region in a broader way?
Thank you. You know, a great philosopher Karl Marx once said, it is not the consciousness of people that form their conditions, it's the conditions that form their consciousness. Whatever he said, right or wrong, this is so true. And John Thompson grew up in the 40s in Washington, D.C. His mother had gotten a degree to become a school teacher, but she couldn't teach because there were no place for Black teachers. Dunbar High School was full. She had to work as a maid. She would take the bus every morning up to Friendship Heights and then go. The white people picked him up and take them to work. He saw this. He saw his father was a welder in a pipe fitter, and his father saw him work every day. His father would stand behind he and his sister and wait till they finished eating. And he said he could hardly read and write, but the smartest man he ever met. And he was molded by that. And then he lived all over Washington, mainly in the first Anacostia, and then along W Street. And he went to the Y, and the Y had this great foundation. And E.P. Henderson started the recreation. So John Thompson is a part of that. But he comes up in a period when the schools, D.C. schools, are very segregated. So he goes to Catholic school, and he goes there, and he plays with Catholic boys. And one was Muck Malloy, who later became the president of Notre Dame. But anyway, they could play in the Catholic League, but they couldn't play. And on weekends, they want to go up to a Chevy Chase Circle to play in games, and they can't play because of segregation. So he sees this. And this is coming through a period of time when other great ball players, now Thompson is not the greatest ball player. He was one of the greatest high school legends. And he went to Boston, but he says he ain't going to Boston. Two things that happened. He played under one of the greatest people who ever played, but Bill Russell never came out of the game. And of course, you remember Bill Russell and Sat Sanders and Cousy, and then you know, of course, the Joneses, Sam and so he was, but he came back to Washington and started coaching. Now, he's also a product of one of the greatest players ever to play. That's Elgin Baylor. And Elgin Baylor comes out here. They call him Rabbit Baylor, and he goes to Spingarn along with Dave Bing. And so they all have this. So D.C. is really becoming on the map. Thompson coaches high school, and then he's brought to Georgetown with almost nothing. They had a losing team. And he starts recruiting, mainly in the inner city, and does this. But what the beauty of Thompson is that he wants to win, but he also wants to mold men. You know, he's very much in the mold of a John Wooden. I read sports books, and I remember what Jabbar said about Wooden. That when I went to school, he taught me that I didn't go to school to learn what to think, but I wanted to learn to think how to think. And John Thompson wanted to create men like this, how to think, how to be. And so he wants to make molds of men. And he has that deflated basketball in his office that says after the basketball. But he has other social conscience. You know, he fights for the rights of people against Proposition 48 and 42 when they want to deny black inner city kids because they don't make so much on a test, on an SAT. And Thompson says he might not have passed the test himself. And then he goes there. But he talks about, and Thompson gets this notion about somehow this thing with whites, and but it's farthest from the truth. One of his closest friends was Red Auerbach. And Red Auerbach lived in D.C. When I first came to D.C., Red Auerbach, the great coach of the Celtics, would drive in the summers. You would see him driving up and down the street in an old Checker car, big old Checker car. Yeah. He'd bring back from Boston. He'd go to Chevy Chase Center. And he would sit and put his chair there, and he would help the kids, help referee. My son went to St. Albans School, and he said, "Dad, a man named Red Auerbach came to our school today." And I said, "Red, do you know who he is?" And the kid was maybe 8 and 10 of them. And so I talked to him. And Auerbach had coached at St. Albans, then he coached at GW, then he coached at the Naval Academy, then he coached at the Celtics. And he said, "Dad, you know, he gave us a lesson." We says, "Coach, what if anything do we need to know to win?" He said one word: cheat. And he was joking. And what he meant by this was, you learn everything. You cut the Celtics. They cut the heat off. They had old parquet floors. They had all of this. But then he meant you learn from others too. Duke Ellington said, "Good musicians borrow, great musicians steal." And he didn't really mean that. But what he meant was you learn from everything, like Picasso learned from the Africans, African Cubism. And so John Thompson took this man. He learned the game from the masters. He learned from Auerbach. He learned from Bill. But he also learned from the great people he had seen in D.C. that came out around the same time. And then he gave the authority, Father Healy at Georgetown, gave him all the authority he needed to succeed. And, you know, in those days, everybody graduated. He had people graduating. He had the great Mutombo. Mm-hmm. And the great Mutombo came. And, of course, Mutombo speaks 6-7 languages, but English wasn't his first language. And the way some of the white kids treated him, the way they treated Patrick Ewing, throwing bananas at them and all this. And Thompson stood up for that and walked off the court, in protest. And so now, Georgetown did become, especially in the age of Iverson, you know, now I have guys come in, and they don't understand. Everybody thinks they one and done. I had a kid last year came in. I'm 6'2". I said, young man, if you know bigger than me, you better study because you're not going to make it. He sort of woofed a little bit. I said, unless your name is Iverson, who is maybe 5'10". But you see, you're not, you have to hit. And so now the struggle is to get the and it's very difficult because people think they you know, they're going to be, you know, one and done. And 90% won't. So we have all of these, you know, we have a kid over Georgetown, Thomas Sorbo, great kid. It looks like he's about 15. He's about 18, 19. Is play. He's not Cooper Flagg. Cooper Flagg is something special, but very good. But now he's going to leave to go to the draft, I hope, because he needs to bulk up, mature. But the pressure, and Thompson would be the first to say, well, I mean, Thompson was a money man. So Tom believed that you have to, you know, you have to, you know, to make the bread to support your family. So he would not, maybe not discourage these young kids from going. He would try to keep them, but he understands that there's so much pressure, if you're very good, to just leave.
Mm-hmm. To just leave. Exactly right. Exactly right. Thompson, such an important figure in the D.C. feel, in the D.C. Chocolate City motif as well, broader in the city. How did his presence loom on the campus and your interactions with John Thompson? How do you characterize that?
Well, I got there, you know, I first went to a graduate school and I got there a little later. And Thompson and I, you know, we had a couple of good conversations. Some things I agree with him. Once the New York Times called me, because some I disagree with him on certain things, the New York Times called me and asked me about something somebody who got in school. So I told them, I said, look, I have nothing to do with the way anybody gets in school. It's not my concern. My concern is getting them out. They wanted me to say something. I said, look, two people I would never argue against. You can say whatever you want. I'm not arguing with you. That's John Thompson and Maya Angelou, because you never win. And so you're not going to win talking to Mr. Song. But he had this because I knew that he had this great concern for us too. But it came hard for him too, because there was pressure. These kids came in. And they may not have been of the mold of Mutombo or Ewing, you know, or Alonzo Mourning. You remember that Alonzo Mourning was there, and the doing the crack epidemic, and the dope dealers and everybody are coming into and trying to lure them. And Thompson speaks up to them, to Rayful Edmonds, and there's a big story about. The big story was that Rayful Edmonds, he's the biggest drug dealer in Washington, is trying to hang out with Alonzo Mourning. And Thompson steps in. And they say, how can you step in with this biggest, this is the biggest, this man is responsible for the deaths of hundreds of people. But Thompson wasn't fearful. And he said, come to my office. He went to his office. And Edmonds left him alone. And so you have this. This is during the period of the Lynn Bias crisis. You remember Lynn Bias was the number two draft selection. He dies of a cocaine overdose. You know, all the great players, Larry Bird, you know, Coach K makes comments about this, what this drug, Thompson speaks up, he understands what drugs are doing in the community and speaks out against that. There's a big meeting over at the St. Anthony, the Catholic Church on at the top peak in Anacostia. It becomes a national show with Ted Koppel. Marion Burr's there, Big John is there, and they speak about this drug crisis. And Thompson is one of the first to really speak up about the drug epidemic in African America. So legendary.
No, absolutely. And John Thompson, if you're comfortable speaking about it, wasn't afraid to speak to some of the big shot callers and dealers. And he didn't stay in the ivory tower of Georgetown. No. That to me has always been a remarkable part of his story.
Well, John Thompson, of course, became a member of the board of Nikes. He spoke to them about athletes, but also he spoke about, especially around the trying to deny African Americans the right to play ball because of, you know, maybe a school. And he says, you get them in college, we can get them up, we can work. But a lot of these kids didn't, you know, they come from backgrounds where I know I lived in Alabama for a couple of years, and when I moved back to Newport News, Virginia, as poor as the schools were in Virginia, they were poor in Alabama. It took me 2 years to catch up, but I caught up. You know, you have the you know, in the pandemic crisis, and African Americans, because many in the family do not have computers. Maybe they have phones, but don't have computers. I got behind, but you can catch up at a certain age. Thompson understood that. He understood, just give somebody a break. And so he was speaking about that. He spoke against the NCAA authorities. He and George Rawlings and Coach Chaney at Temple became legendary because they spoke up. You know, he's offered a chance. I remember he was offered a chance to go coach the Denver Nuggets, but he couldn't control. Because John Thompson is going to control. He's going to run his own show. I remember Jack DeJoria, my dear friend, who was the president emeritus of Georgetown, when I got there, he said, I'm Thompson's boss. I said, really? Somebody's Thompson's boss? But he really was. But Thompson was that he had this relationship with the school for free reign. But they knew that he wanted, first and foremost, the education of these kids. And he had a woman, Miss Mary Finland, this little white lady, ex-nun, who stood on the bench as an assistant coach, I was scared of Miss Finland because you didn't cross her. She would come there. She'd make sure the boys went to school. Today, I have kids, and I see them coming to class, and the coordinator's driving them to class in a little golf cart. And I look, I said, are you driving this big ass to class? He can't walk to class? You know, what is this? So, and sometimes it's just the way we sort of, you know, nurture them a bit too much. And John Thompson was tough love. And he said, I cussed you out, but you knew I loved you when they cussed out. And he talks about his relationship, especially with Dean Smith, and how much he learned and admired from Dean Smith. He said, Dean Smith taught me that the first thing you teach these kids is to how to eat properly in a restaurant. And, you know, in those days, you know, everybody wore a necktie, and none of his guys could wear a facial hair. Of course, he had to change that later. And he said, Dean Smith taught me how to go and buy a good suit and all these things that are necessary. And so he learns from people, especially his love of Dean Smith and Red Auerbach.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt it's a coincidence that Dean Smith was somebody who, in the middle of, you know, Dixie, North Carolina, you know, cared about racial justice. I'm sure that made an impression on John Thompson.
And Dean Smith did it without speaking publicly. He never spoke. He never said. He said the lessons he taught John, never embarrass the kid in public. Give them the chance. The relationship he had with Michael Jordan, you can make a difference. You don't have to be the most vocal person as long as you work. And so he taught that the main thing is to raise these young men and look at the guy, James Worthy and Jordan, and all those who come out of there. And then they go back, you know, to Carolina and do things. And Georgetown has had that, you know, they built this big John Thompson Center. It took $100 million. And the players donate a lot of money. This is Mutombo and Ewing and Mourning and many others. And most of those have sent their sons back to Georgetown to play. They just, you know, it's hard to be a Patrick Ewing Jr. It's hard to be a Deke Jr. or Mourning Jr. because these guys are so great. But he understood that each one of those came from a particularly unique situation. Mutombo from Congo, Mourning raised by foster parents in Chesapeake, Virginia. Ewing, who comes to Boston Latin from Jamaica, and the difficulties, but John Thompson gave them that. But the school was behind, the professors were behind, the teachers, the whole university wanted them to succeed. Now kids come in and leave so quick, it's hard to get a handle on things, except in a women's game, of course. And they stay, and you see what happens when people stay. People stayed at Houston. These guys have been there 5-6 years. You see what happens when you can stay in school.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's odd watching the game now and seeing 18-year-old one and duns versus 24-year-old took the extra year from COVID. They're in their sixth year. They're on their third team. It's something else. Like everybody was marveling about Jaden Daniels' maturity. I love Jaden Daniels, but everybody was marveling about his maturity as a quarterback, and I was like, of course he's mature. He's been around already.
He's been around a while, He played. He's been around. He's great. He stayed in school.
Yeah, of course. Several schools. You know, he's lived, you know.
Yeah.
You've been so generous with your time. The book is utterly incredible. I'm reading it. My wife's reading it. I'm recommending it to people. Rhythms of Resistance and Resilience, How Black Washingtonians Use Music and Sports and the Fight for Equality by Maurice Jackson. I hope you have time. I'd really love to ask you a couple more questions.
Though, I do have time. I do
beyond
have time.
The book. The first is just about When you moved to DC in the 1970s, I'm assuming, based on some of what you've said, that you had thrown yourself into the fight for home rule at that time. Is that a correct thing to say, first and foremost, that you were part of the home rule movement, or?
Yeah, but when I came, there were two things. There were either voting representation and statehood. And voting representation passed because D.C. Had home rule authority in 1973. And in the midst of that, there was a fight also for statehood, led by, the great Julius Hobson, which is a battle that people have been fought. D.C. has more population than South Dakota and Delaware and Vermont and places like that. Now I think it pays tax more taxes than 10 states, but it's denied those rights that a state would have.
Wow. So, having been part of that struggle, what are you seeing today? I mean, it very much looks like Congress has accepted this Congress, this Doge Congress, this Trump Congress is going to strip Washington, D.C. of any. Do you think, first of all, am I overstating what they're going to do? Because one thing, like, they're saying they're going to run this city like it's a federal agency. I don't even understand conceptually how that could even happen. But then they don't seem to care.
No, they don't seem to care, and I don't think it's quite as easy to do as they think it is. It has to go through because when DC got its voting right, it had to go through Congress and signed by a president. Whether they can repeal that, I don't think legally they can, but they don't care about
Legally,
the law.
yeah.
DC and what they want to hold $1 billion. This is money that DC people have paid. This is not money that belongs to the federal government. But under the Home Rule Authority, any law that passed, any budget passed, it must get approved for Congress. And so this is the question of gun control. It's the question of needle exchange. It's the question of reproductive freedom. All these questions, and it's the day-to-day running. A couple of years ago, in the early 90s, D.C. got in financial default, just as New York and many other Cleveland and many other cities did, and they had what they call a control board. And it was run by people and got DC back on his finance and led the way to Williams becoming the mayor. So DC is going through crisis and period of time. I don't know. See, here's the question also, Dave, that the leadership of the city has not done such a good job in making it a place where African Americans can stay. They've not done such a good job in creating job opportunities and things like that. They've not been. And so now, when you're in the midst of all this, it's very easy to say that Trump is at the fault for all the conditions in Washington. DC was gentrified long before Trump came. The question is, what we do to stop it? And this, he doesn't care. We know that. And so, what do we do? And the main thing is to create housing, and there's money in the budget to create educational opportunities. Do you know? So you talk about this. When I came to DC, you could get a job in federal government with a high school degree. Now you need a master's degree. Most people getting jobs in the federal government who are coming in now are not black people. But now, of course, people, we talk. I've talked to some young whites lately, poor young kids. I mean, they come here for a job, but want to make a difference in health and human service or something, like, and then they're fired the next day. So it is treacherous. But DC has to fight for the retention of that home rule. Many people thought that we would get statehood a couple of years ago. The great Edward Kennedy was probably the best friend in Congress DC ever had. And he said DC, the reason they don't want to give DC full voting, full home rule, is because it has the four twos: too black, too poor, too urban, and too liberal. Well, now they think that has changed. So you walk in DC, the city is so much more beautiful than when I came. In the 70s, neighborhoods are changed. But you go to Howard University, the mecca of black education. You look across the street where the Wonderbread factory used to be. All those houses, beautiful houses, and black people can't afford to live there. So it's all people who come. Now, I'm not against people coming, but create opportunities for people in the city too. And so you have all of this, but the population is leaving because people cannot afford. They're not creating affordable housing. As we could, and it's not that hard to do it. And so what happened, one mayor, and I've seen it to you, the mayor, the past mayor, asked me if I would do a study on why so many people live in D.C. leaving. And so I did a study. But the city didn't give me any help to do it. So I got the president of Georgetown, Jack DeZoy, and others, and I did the economic research, and we put together a program about trying to keep, and it really comes down to jobs, education. Now, so D.C. has its own budget. This is not money that comes from Congress. It is the money the D.C. taxpayer, the billions of dollars, and how do you use that money? Now they're trying to hold that up. That becomes the... will it happen? I don't know. I tend to think that it may be a little bit more difficult, but people have every right, court right to fight, because these are things that are constitutionally enabled. The fact that D.C. Became, had voting rights first in Congress, in presidential election in 70, and then in 1973, what we call home rule.
Yeah, and it's difficult to see without a black working class in the city. Like, where's the movement going to come from, even to push Congress back? I'm just hoping you could speak to that. Like, where do you see prospects for the change?
Well, you know, there are people who are speaking up. I must say, in Congress, Jamie Raskin, who's your representative, has spoken out beautifully. But Raskin grew up on Wyoming Avenue, right in Adams Morgan and what, so he knows the city. The labor unions, but here's what's happening, Dave. The labor unions are being cut. They're stopping American Federation of Government work. They are laying off so many thousands of people in these jobs who are workers. And so many of the people, you know, millions of workers in the DMV, the majority are not white, are not black. The majority are white. The majority in D.C. are black. So you have in D.C., you have all the workers who come in from Maryland and Virginia. And see, what happens is, if you live in New York City, if you work in New York City and live in New Jersey, you pay your payroll taxes in New York City. Mm. If you live in Virginia, Maryland, and work in D.C., you pay your taxes to the states you live in, because that is what Hume rule, that is the way they clamp it up. And so that's what the fight for statehood, to use those taxes. Nonetheless, all the money that businesses and companies and things will pay like that are money D.C. raised. But we have to get Congress's approval for every single step. So I think it's a battle, but I think it can be won, because constitutionally, of course, there's no basis of. But I don't really know if Trump and those really want to run. I mean, this is a tough city to run. Crime is actually not going up. It is actually going down. But it's the wrong kinds of crime that are going up. And there's so many problems, in our city with the inner city schools and things like that. We just need to pay close attention to it. And the city council has to really come out. You know, the mayor is in a precarious position. People worry too much. She had to take the Black Lives Matter sign, so the sign is taken down. Well, that's not the biggest worry about the sign. It is a worry, but they have more things to worry about, and that is children's health, maternal health, all those things.
No, that's right. That's right. And also, being at Georgetown, I have to ask you about Badr Khan Suri. The student, the researcher, the grad student, the assistant professor who was seized in front of his apartment by ICE, taken away. He's still in a detention center in Louisiana in this ICE hell. No one really knows what's happening with him. At least I certainly don't. How has that affected, if at all, the mood on campus? This idea that an assistant professor can just be swooped off the streets by people in masks without badges, right, and just his class gets abandoned. Right. The school has to deal with that. The fear factor among international students. Like, can you give us some sense about that?
Well, he wasn't captain on the campus. He was. But the university has made a strong statement that they condemn this, and they want and they hope it doesn't happen. You know, in Washington D.C., there's a elementary school called Bancroft, and Bancroft Elementary School, the ICE went in, and the teachers stood there and stopped them from coming in. Now, these are elementary school teachers. These are young black and white Latino people. They stopped them. Whether people at Georgetown do, I don't know, but there have been many protests, and we've and the administration's come down saying they would not allow our chapter of the American University of American Association of University Professors has spoken out against it. So we certainly do condemn. We meet there at rallies almost every day about this. And what happens now is that it must be up to those people who do have citizenship, who are citizens, who have their paper thing, to really speak out to professors and the students. You know, we've made as many statements, but we've made hundreds of statements. But at a certain point, it goes beyond that. And that's why when so many people came out the other day at all these demonstrations, it took me back when I first came to anti-war demonstrations. And they had been lacking, and now they will pick up. I'm afraid that, you know, the way this economy is going and the way the nation is looking, I don't see how all of these things can sustain. So here's the thing. If you know that in Vietnam, people spoke up when they started seeing a lot of white bodies coming home. I remember, and you probably remember, that on Saturdays you would see the bodies come in at Dover, Delaware, and they'd come in. And during the wars in the Middle, the problem in the Middle East, you don't see that. They stopped it. But now you see the effect. Now you're seeing the effects of when you see white farmers and they buy these big combines that are worth millions of dollars, and then they can't make the payments on those because they can't sell the crops that they grow to help starving people in Somalia. When you see that effect, when you see polio rising up, 2 million people will die of polio next year. Millions would die of tuberculosis, all the diseases. When you see that people cannot get the drugs that they need to survive, and this is going to really hit white America pretty soon. When Mr. Trump says, oh, $3,000 more in tax, nobody's going to complain. Yes, they will, because $3,000 is a lot of money. So when you see people who may have gone to Canada and other places like that to get the medicine they need because they can't afford them here, cannot do it. Yeah. I think that is going to, when the American people are going to feel some hurt. And I can only think that many, including many white Americans, are going to speak up.
Yeah, let alone tourism, as people are just now canceling trips to the United States left and right.
Is that right? Oh, okay.
They don't want to, you know, and that of course has that ripple effect through hotels, through restaurants, through businesses. A place like New York, for example, and D.C. that depend on tourism.
Well, D.C. and tourism, and then of course the Canadian borders. And I was in class the other day, so I just pulled out the list. It was the New York Times, and it was a list of about 300 words that you can't use. I don't know if you saw it.
I did.
And so I asked the students, so all these things is affecting life and everything. And then the national education, the National Endowment for the Arts. And now he's, of course, what he's done at the Kennedy Center, and then attacking now the Smithsonian, which is an independent agency. And he closed the Woodrow Wilson Center down. I'd had fellowships in many of these places before. And this is what allows scholars to do their independent thinking.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we have to, you know, we've always been a people of hope. And the time now is to take that hope and put it into some effort, the demonstration, things like that. You know, it's easy for me to say this one because people are suffering, but I tend to think that the next 2 years are going to be so important. The change to Congress. You look at what happened in Wisconsin. Sometimes money doesn't prove everything. We saw, you know, the hatred. The venom that went towards that. So we tend to think that, and many local areas are speaking up. The president of Princeton, that brother, you know, he's not, but that man is spoken out forcefully at certain places. Some other schools, Harvard and others, well, they get so much money, they may not speak out, but they will have to if they want a justice to live in a just society.
Exactly. I always ask people this when I interview them, bringing it back to the book. I don't know how you're going to answer this question of all people. But I always ask people who've written books how music may have played a role in the writing of the book in terms of what plays in the background when you write, or in terms of what plays in the background maybe after you write when you need a bit of a mental break after the exercise that goes into writing a book. You're, of course, a very prolific author. I'm sure that this answer changes. But with this book in particular, that has music as such a core of it, what music was your muse?
Well, you know, Dave, when I'm writing, I can't listen to anything because my mind is you know, I come upstairs because even a tick of a noise, I just can't. So I come in the room and at the top floor, and I don't listen to anything, no music, anything. The construction, well, not the construction, but the traffic on 60 doesn't bother me. Even a TV, this, but anything I can concentrate now. But afterwards, then I go listen, and I listen to. The great Charlie Hayden was one of my dearest friends, the great bass player who wrote so many songs about a people's struggle. And I did liner notes for him, a CD called Steal Away, another one called Come Sunday. I go listen to Charlie Hayden. My main man is Ornette Coleman. I love Ornette Coleman, and I go listen to Ornette Coleman and Coltrane. I go listen to some Shirley Horn. I go listen to, late at night, I go listen. But when I'm writing, because I'm, you know, some people learn to write at a very young age. I grew up in the South, and then I got very active in the movement, and I worked as a longshoreman for a while, and then as a construction worker. So writing did not come natural to me. I have to really work at it. Every word is acting, but I've done pretty good, and luckily I have a good editors. But when I'm writing, I just have to have nothing but me, but then after that I get up and I have to go in the basement. Because my wife said the music is too loud, so I go down there and just put it up. I'm not much of a sleeper, so I still collect. I have a bunch of records down in a lot of CDs and things like that. And you know, so many young musicians are coming out, man. They're killing. And so many young musicians from the Washington D.C. area. You know, Kush Abaday on drums up in New York playing with Cecilia DeLaurent Ben Williams and Corcoran Holt and so many others coming out. And then this woman, Samira Joy, who sings, and she's doing such good work. And my dear friend, Jason Moran, who's the head of jazz at the Kensington, the work that he's doing. So, you know, these young musicians really do inspire because they are using the music as a social message, and they're using it with art, and they are playing to the music of as they are looking at the art of Elizabeth Cattley and things like that. So there's hope in this music. People say, is jazz dead? No, jazz is doing just fine. A lot of support may not be there, but it will come back.
Oh, I agree with you about that. His name is Maurice Jackson. He's a legend in these parts. His book is called How Black Washingtonians Used Music and Sports in the Fight for Equality. Mr. Jackson, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast.
Okay, and always just plain Maurice, always Maurice. Thank you very much, and I look forward to it. I get the Nation every week. I read it, get it in print, and so thank you for all the work that you have doing to help. And I want to read your take on the NCAA tournaments.
Oh, it's coming, believe me. Hey, we'll be back right after this. After a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine.
We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey, everybody out there. This is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it. But we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast.
Ari Drennan, thank you so much for joining us here on the Edge of Sports podcast.
Thanks for having me. I don't think I ever thought I'd be on a sports podcast, but here we are.
Here we are. I mean, you're in that world right now with a very important study. First and foremost, before we get into what your MMA UFC study says to us, can you give us a little background on the demographics of who watches UFC? Who is the audience that is receiving all of these right-wing politics ideas that are coming from the ring and from the executive suites of UFC?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a very male audience and also a very young audience. So you've got this overlap of People who, you know, everyone was sort of surprised by the way that they voted in the last election. But you've got this overlap in the audience, and then it's also a really large audience. So obviously the most famous of the podcasts in this space is the Joe Rogan Experience, which has almost 40 million subscribers on Spotify now, right? That's like an audience level it's hard to even imagine. 40 million people tuning into any one thing in this like era of media that we're in. It's almost like Survivor, at the peak of Survivor, how many people were tuned in there. And obviously those people aren't all listening to all 3 hours of every episode. But that's kind of like the largest group of those people. And then you have a lot of other large influencers in that space, many of whom are growing.
And I can tell you from the experience of some of the folks I know, you almost have Joe Rogan as a status symbol on your pod. It doesn't necessarily mean you listen every day. And as you said, most people can't stomach all 3 hours of that blathering gas bag. So it's a lot to listen to. So I always thought of the 40 million number as something that does Joe a little bit too many favors. But you're absolutely correct in that, you know, it is, the depending on the week, the number one or number two podcast in existence. So its power.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I mean, I've listened to a fair share of episodes, and the number of them that I've gotten all the way to the end 3 hours in of is very, very low.
Yeah, it's a slog. All right, so let's get to the study. I found your study fascinating. I have so many specific questions, but give us the broad strokes. What does your study show?
So we were trying to just take a look at this space in line with some of the broader Media Matters research that we've done recently, which found that nine out of 10 of the top online shows feature right-wing political messages. And this includes non-political spaces like comedy, sports. The UFC is kind of a particular outlier here. So what we found in this is that UFC figures like Joe Rogan, Sean Strickland, Jake Shields, and Bryce Mitchell are fueling widespread misinformation and hostility towards trans people through anti-trans narratives that are kind of in the background of these shows as listeners tune in. This isn't really a new trend. So UFC commentary has long featured anti-trans animus, including years of attacks against Fallon Fox, who was a trans MMA fighter. But it is something that I think people should be aware of.
Let's talk a little bit about the attacks on trans people, because it was so central to a good deal of the report that Media Matters put out. Looking at the last, say, history since Fallon Fox, do you think the attacks on trans people have been a gateway to a broader set of right-wing politics? Or did that already exist and then trans people became just another group that people involved with UFC were going after?
That's a really key question. And I think that this conversation, for lack of a better term, about trans athletes has largely served as kind of an entry point into this broader pipeline of radicalization. So, you know, you'll tune in, you'll hear things about, you know, Caitlyn Jenner being called an anti-trans slur, or people saying that being trans is a mental illness. But then it gets, you know, and that's obviously really, really bad stuff, but it gets from there to, you know, Jake Shields, for example, attacking a California state senator as, quote, a child groomer and a Jew. And a lot of stuff like that, with this kind of virulent anti-Semitism that actually it exists pretty broadly in this world and is very, very concerning.
No, certainly. All right, let's talk about one of the guy on the top of the pyramid here, Dana White. Talk a little bit. I think people may be aware of Dana White now in a more broad political sense. You know, his presence at the inauguration, speaking at the RNC. But who is Dana White?
Yeah, Dana White has really been out there on this issue. So people are hearing more and more about him. I mean, he was somebody that was brought in on, if you remember, the Bud Light controversy, where they Tried to really make an example out of Bud Light for having sent a single can of beer to a trans influencer on Instagram. Dana White was someone who came in and tried to kind of rehabilitate the Bud Light brand with the help of Joe Rogan. But Dana White, for those who aren't familiar, is the president of the UFC. He's a Trump ally and donor who's repeatedly used the organization to benefit the president's political ambitions. This again isn't new. In September 2020, for example, White and several UFC fighters were advocating for Trump's reelection. He's gone on campaign rallies and bus tours, and he endorsed Trump at the 2020 Republican National Convention.
Mm-hmm. Now, to get back to Joe Rogan, you mentioned something briefly in the report that I want to go back to, because looking back, I think of it as the canary in the coal mine. You mentioned journalist Parker
yeah.
Malloy. I know Parker, and I was thinking about this when I read that, about like, wow, yeah, that really felt almost like the start of something when Parker on Twitter, back when Twitter was this sort of wide open space, and you know, someone like a journalist like Parker could engage someone like Joe Rogan, and they could have a big debate on Twitter. And you know, that was one of the cool things about it at the time. And but I mean, tell me if I'm remembering this right. It was less the debate and more how Rogan's people responded to Parker during and after the debate. Is that, and can you speak a little bit about what that debate was, and am I remembering it correctly?
You'd actually have to refresh my memory on the specific incident that
Oh, sure.
You're referencing. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. It started with talking about Fallon Fox, and it then became Parker going back at Rogan with statistics coming out of the NCAA's research at that time about the effects of things like hormone therapy on trans women and or non-binary trans people in women's sports. And Rogan not really having an answer to the actual research and the science, fumbling and bumbling a little bit, but then this really like unholy backlash against Parker for daring to challenge King Joe. I look back at that now, and I just think, okay, you know, I remember that, and I remember not thinking what Parker was doing was that controversial. She was just speaking some truth to someone with a big following, as was a pretty common thing on Twitter.
Yeah.
And then, but it provoked something uglier than we'd seen in previous debates of this kind.
Yeah, Parker is a great journalist and a friend of mine, and certainly someone who's never afraid to speak truth to power. I think that does really speak to the ways in which it's hard to just have any kind of conversation about this stuff, because, you know, if somebody happens to be trans and is trying to have a role in this conversation, the attacks tend to be so personal and vitriolic. And, you know, this includes like people calling Fallon Fox a sick sociopath, a disgusting freak. In 2020, people were calling her a professional woman beater.
Mm-hmm.
People were posting photos claiming that she'd broken female opponents' skulls of people that she'd never fought before. And so, you know, this isn't a conversation that ends up having a lot of statistics or a real reliance on science at all. It's very emotional. It's very personal. It's very, very based on appearance. And, you know, that tends to hurt the trans people who are involved, but it's also hurting many of the cisgender women who fight in the UFC.
Mm. Now, you know, there have been people in the world of mixed martial arts in years past who have spoken to issues of resistance, of the rights of the downtrodden, of people who are marginalized in our society. But I am thinking back quite a few years. Does the space exist at this point for that to take place? I know Dana White loves to talk about free speech when it comes to pro-Hitler people who do their thing in UFC. But do you think that free speech exists both ways in its current formation?
I think we're seeing this environment where trans people are being threatened and silenced and afraid to speak up, and allies of trans people too. I mean, this is obviously a little far afield from the sports world, but I don't know if you saw that there was a teacher in Florida earlier this month who was fired just for referring to one of her students by their chosen name without permission from the state, the school district. There's not really reason in this debate. And I think it's really notable that the right was very, very focused on free speech in this space. And then, the second that they got a taste of power and control, have gone on trying to, censor the word trans from government websites, make it impossible for government agencies or scientists to even talk about it. And, at the end of the day, it's really hard to have an informed conversation about fairness and safety in sports when one side is really trying to shut down any scientific understanding of the actual differences involved.
Unprecedented censorship by the free speech brigades, certainly in my lifetime.
Funny how that happens.
Yeah. One might even think that the right in this country isn't sincere in their beliefs. I mean, tariffs. Okay. Sorry. There's so many.
No, it's okay. I mean, I do think it's worth noting, it's worth noting that Joe Rogan in particular has spent a lot of time attacking the use of federal money in, at one point he attacked quote unquote transgender monkey studies, which had, it was an attempt to understand HIV more, which I think most people would agree that it's good for the government to research disease and understand, who's at risk. And it's just really notable that it's all like, oh, we should have a debate about this until somebody tries to actually bring some science into it.
Yeah, no, science has a liberal bias, of course, to paraphrase Stephen Colbert. Well, one last question for you. I appreciate you giving the time. You may have seen polls this week about support for Trump going down, and the most notable part, it's gone down on every age demographic by a pretty significant margin, except for one where it was not just pretty significant, but profoundly significant. People ages 18 to 30 from +5 Trump when he was inaugurated, now it's -29. A 34-point drop among people ages 18 to 30, according to this YouGov poll. Does that say to us that perhaps the fear that the youth are being captured by MAGA and fascistic thoughts and MMA being a tool for that, is that at least a sign that this is maybe 50 feet wide and half an inch thick, and as soon as reality imposes itself on the flash and the good times, it's you get a very, we could see a profound shift among young people coming off 2024, I guess, is the question that I'm asking.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, one of the things about putting a lot of stock in the most recent voting behavior of young people is that is the group that's most malleable and most prone to adapting to circumstances. And so, they saw a campaign from a guy who, maybe they remember as having presided over a strong economy, arguing that he's going to come in and put an end to the culture war, which I think everyone is pretty tired of constantly hearing about. And, then he comes in and it's just about they, them all the time, right? Yesterday, one of the top stories on Fox News, as the stock market is dropping in response to these tariffs, is a story about how the White House won't respond to reporters with pronouns in their email signatures. I mean, it's just this kind of juvenile nonsense that, I think people who might have voted for Trump or maybe even stayed home in the presidential election under the idea that he would be focused on pocketbook issues are probably going to be really disappointed with what they've seen coming out of this White House, which has been, you know, economic gamesmanship, a hyper focus on LGBTQ people, and kind of indiscriminate deportations of people who haven't even been accused of crimes. I mean, I just don't think that's an agenda that's going to be popular with many people anywhere.
No, it's an agenda of people who don't think they're going to have to face real action. And I think that's something we need to be very, very cognizant of, especially if these polls continue to look how they're going, how they're looking right now for the chief in charge here. And I'm not
it's
talking
really
about Dana White or Elon Musk, but the other one running our country. Well, Ari Drennan, thank you so much for joining us here on the Edge of Sports podcast. I really appreciate you bringing not just your expertise, but also the work of Media Matters to our show.
Anytime.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you to Maurice Jackson. Thank you to Ari Drennan. Just a reminder, Maurice Jackson's book is called Rhythms of Resistance and Resilience, How Black Washingtonians Used Music and Sports in the Fight for Equality. Thank you, Nation Magazine. Thank you to my producer, Dave Tigaboo. If you like this show, by all means, you know what to do. Give it love, give it support, however you can. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.